In 1964, Bob was one of the first people at Bell Labs to have a terminal in his home. His modem carried data back and forth at an excruciatingly slow rate of 135 bits per second, about a tenth of the speed of the slowest of today's most common modems. Retrieving or sending even a small amount of information was a process that left plenty of time to go get a cup of coffee while the modem churned away. The terminal itself, called an IBM 2741, looked like an oversized IBM typewriter with an IBM type ball mechanism. The typewriter perched atop a pedestal, and inside the pedestal was a mass of electronics. Later came a slightly faster terminal, the Teletype Model 37, a cumbersome affair that was roughly half the size of a standard desk. The teletype terminal had a mechanical encoding grid of rods under the keys that converted keystrokes into binary signals, which in turn made their way over a modem into the Bell Labs central computer. Any Bell Labs scientist with a terminal got to know the repairman pretty well. Every repair visit finished with an oiling of the encoding mechanism. The next time the terminal was used, fresh oil often dripped onto the user's legs. In the early 1960s, computer security wasn't a problem. Locked doors sufficed. It first became an issue with time-shared computers. The original idea of time-sharing was simply that everybody could apparently have his own computer when he needed it, with the cost shared among many people. This was the first time people had thought about sharing the power of a computer. With the development of time-sharing, there arose the need for accounting and security mechanisms of some kind, because more than one person at a time could use a computer. Multics was one of the first time-sharing systems that paid real attention to security as an explicit design goal. The main goal of Multics, a joint research project of MIT, Bell Labs, and General Electric, was to make time-sharing commercially available. The dream was that Multics would be a computer utility with capabilities far beyond those of existing commercial time-sharing systems. It had to permit cooperation among users who wanted it while guaranteeing privacy to others. The earliest self-described computer hackers, those at MIT who abhorred computer security or anything else that would inhibit the sharing of information and free access to computers, had it in for Multics from the start. MIT hackers often tried to bring the system to its knees, and occasionally they succeeded. But ultimately, Multics developed to the point of becoming too unwieldy. As Morris would describe it many years later, continuing to support its development was like kicking a dead whale down a beach. Bell Labs pulled out of the project in early 1969, after which Multics was adopted by Honeywell as a secure operating system to run on military computers. But the Tiger Teams of the 1970s, groups of people who were authorized to probe the security of Defense Department computers by trying to break into them, put Multics computers through rigorous tests and eventually got in. The teams even managed to confound the system's meticulous audit trail, modifying it so there would be no trace of a penetration of the computer. Breaking into computers in order to improve security was an important tactic used by people who worked in the field of computer security. Members of a Tiger team were allowed to have at least limited access to a target computer. That was one thing. But what about those would-be invaders with no legal access at all? People like Bob Morris and Ken Thompson, another talented computer scientist, thought about such problems extensively. The first step, of course, would be for intruders to find out what telephone numbers dialed into a computer, perhaps by using a scanning program that could dial every possible telephone number sequentially. 10 years later, it would be common for 12-year-old computer hackers to write programs similar to those they saw depicted in the movie War Games. If a hacker's modem detected another computer, signaled by a high-pitched tone, his next step was to log in and identify himself to the computer's satisfaction by supplying an account name and a password. Unless the perpetrator already had inside information of some kind, coming up with the correct password could be the most difficult step. But once he had logged in, it was possible for him, depending on the level of privileges achieved, to enter other computers over a network illicitly. Bob's interest in computer security grew with the development of Unix, the successor to Multics. Unix was a play on the name Multics, where Multics was complex and its name referred to computing in multiples. Unix signified simplicity and uniformity. Unix began as a backlash to the Multics system. It was developed for a small computer, and programmers grew to like it for two primary reasons. Its flexibility let them tailor it to suit the needs of whatever program they were working on, and it was designed to be portable, meaning it could be made to work on computers of many different brands. Future versions of the system grew slightly in complexity as new capabilities were added, but each new edition of Unix remained faithful to the principles of simplicity. Unix would bring fame to a few Bell Labs programmers and become a fixture at universities and research institutions around the world. The Unix development team consisted of two principals, Ken Thompson and Dennis Ritchie, and a peripheral group that made smaller contributions. Bob's work on Unix involved the mathematical functions of the software. Something as simple as asking for the time, for instance, involved a calculation. But his main interest lay in writing the encoding algorithm used in Unix, the procedure that transformed the uncoded plain text in a file into encrypted text. When Bob wrote the Crypt program, his fascination with ciphers intensified. He was a mathematician, and his deepest interest lay in number theory, which typically involves the study of prime numbers and creative uses of randomness. Cryptology is a natural extension of number theory, since it requires turning a message of clear text into a code through manipulation of numbers. Cryptology is more than a mathematical discipline. It requires linguistic skills as well. To do exceptional work in cryptology requires remarkable intuition and leaps of imagination. Morris had that. He also had an ability to see the security holes where others saw protection. In the mid-1970s, Morris was working on a method of cracking the encryption machines developed during the 1930s by a Swedish cryptologist named Boris Hagelin. The machine, known as the M209, was an updated version of the earlier German Enigma machine used by the Nazis in World War II, which was decoded in 1939 by British cryptoanalysts, including the famous mathematician Alan Turing. The M209, which looked like a cash register with letters as its keys, coded messages in such a way that each letter was turned into one of more than 100 million possible substitutes. Morris devised an elegant method for taking a passage of text encoded by the M209 and transforming it into clear, readable English without relying on machines. At the same time, Jim Reeds, then a mathematician at the University of California at Berkeley, came up with a different method for breaking the code that could be done with a computer program. Reeds and Morris learned of each other's work, and with the help of Dennis Ritchie, created a program that would read encoded text and generate a clear translation. The trio then wrote a joint paper describing their feat and submitted it to the academic journal Cryptologia. At the same time, however, as a courtesy, Bob sent a preprint of the paper to the National Security Agency, whose mission, indeed whose very existence, was largely unknown to the general public at the time. The NSA spreads a far-flung net for gathering communications intelligence in every corner of the world. For example, when a Korean airliner strayed off course in 1983 and was shot down by a Soviet interceptor, NSA monitors captured the radio conversation between the Russian pilot and his flight controllers. And in 1989, when the United States accused a German company of selling materials that enabled Libyans to build a poison gas plant, intelligence on the matter was gathered by a massive and permanent NSA communication surveillance operation in Europe. The mission of the NSA, which was classified until recently, also required that the agency maintain the world's best cryptographic capabilities. The NSA maintained that it was not in its interest for the most advanced cryptographic research to be widely disseminated to the public. So it was perhaps not surprising that shortly after submitting their paper to the agency for review, the three computer scientists received a visit from a retired Virginia gentleman to discuss the impending publication of the paper. He was, in fact, a former intelligence officer and still had close ties with his former employers. The agency was divided, he told them. Some didn't see a problem with the article, but one conservative group was opposed to any publication of information that would advance the public knowledge of cryptography. The initial contact over lunch at Bell Labs led to other meetings. The researchers traveled to visit agency officials several times. In the end, the Bell Labs scientists decided to withdraw the paper. As Ritchie remembers the incident, it was at this time that Bob Morse's flirtation with the NSA began. What went on inside America's most secret intelligence agency held a certain fascination for all of them, and for Morse in particular. Already, the NSA was a customer for Unix and the accompanying C programming language that the Bell Labs group had designed. Morse was offered a summer appointment at the Institute for Defense Analyses, the NSA's classified think tank. But at this point, all three still felt that if they took security clearances, it would mean sacrificing much of the freedom they enjoyed as outsiders. They decided to keep their contact with the computer spooks informal.